Session number 6274, Rio 2.
Mr. John Milton, Reel 2.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking over the last, half an hour or so about various subjects, and one of them in particular was your recollections of the Second War Rooms. And I wonder if you could perhaps describe to me from perhaps how the War Rooms were entered, and then on how they were organised.
Yes. Well, when you came in to Daldasil, one was unaware that a building existed to hold a government of ours at the time, namely Churchill's government. No one from outside would ever imagine the wall in Brook Street, that there was a large bunker. It was deep in stature, and that this actual building consisted of 34 rooms on 3 floors, and even on the ground level, you know, people would never realise that Mr. Churchill himself had a bedroom, had a bathroom there with wash basins. But I can remember first going to Dulles Hill and going into this big iron gate, going into a concrete floor, and then down these large solid concrete steps, 2 flights down, and then to another door. And then you can imagine this if you were going into an underground station. By virtue of the fact it was all lit up, I should think it was like as if we were being buried alive in a grave. But when you came to your senses, you really could see for yourself what it was. Offices with names on doors. And when I went down, and I went down another flight of stairs around the corner, and there behold was a large room. And you know, I wonder what was in that room. And I went inside, and there was a large cabinet table, a large table. I imagine it was a conference room. Then that kind of told me that it was the war cabinet room. It was furnished with a large blue tablecloth on it, and about 20 chairs all around it. And he told me at the time, he said, you know, we're getting this ready, and as you've just come, he said, I'm going to tell you all about it. And this is the Mr. Churchill's war cabinet war room. And if he comes out, we've got to lay out all the blotters, ashtrays. And he said to me, he said, you'll have to get a fire bucket out for his, as you know, he smokes cigars, and he smokes a lot. So you'll have to get that all out. But I said, where do you keep it all? Well, he said, it's all put away, not for safety reasons, because we're safe here. But it's kept away because of the accumulation of dust that gets through the air ducts, although they're filtered, he said. You still get a certain amount of... He said, incidentally, look over in the corner there, he said, even that concrete wall is still letting in water. Although there was lino on the floor, about half-inch thick lino. Of course, the building was very well linoed out. Even the map rooms had a half-inch lino on the walls to hold the maps. And he did say that one of the people who put the lino on the walls told me, he said, you know what we're paying for this lino that's going in these map rooms? He said 27.6 a square yard. Well, that was a lot of money in those days, wasn't it? 27.6 to put a map on. But I watched them do it, and I also watched them lay the lino on the floors. They lay the tar first, and then they roll the carpet down, but they don't cut it to the correct length because they reckon it'll expand. The same with the carpets. It opened my eyes to see as well when the HM officer worked carpet layers, who lay carpets in government offices, use large forks. And they put the 3 prongs into the carpet and they knock it with their hand or rest it on their knee, and they knock it like that. And that stretches the carpet till it meets another carpet piece. And that's how they laid the carpets, and that's how they stretched them as well, by using a large fork, a very heavy fork, to lay the carpets. Well, as I say, all these rooms were fitted, and they really looked nice, and I did come to the conclusion that one day we were going to be occupied. And as I said just now to you, that we did have a dress rehearsal, but after that things went quite... But nevertheless, it still remained important, and right throughout the war, and it was still meant to be what it was set out to be at the early part of the war. And I think that if the British wartime government cabinet had come out there, they would have been pretty safe. We did have enemy air raids overhead, and even on D-Day we saw many thousands of aircraft going over Dulles Hill. The Second Front, I remember that, it was only yesterday.
The actual war rooms themselves were only just one part of the main GPO complex. Is that...
Oh, yes.
That's the case,
yes. Yes, the GPO also had their own war rooms at the other end of their own building, because very few people, when I say very few people, I mean the public, knew what was going on in Dulles Hill Research Station. It was a research station for researching not only telephone cables, but underwater sea cables. As a matter of fact, one very well-known gentleman, who was, I think, actually the head of GPO, he was, even in the war years, wartime at Dulles Hill, experimenting with atoms. And now we hear so much about it that it's now commonplace. But nevertheless, I think that Dulles Hill served its purpose well. We were ready. And that if any emergency did come about, we were there to take over and keep the wheels of government working.
You spoke in the break about, you believe that there was a direct link between the GPO headquarters and the Ultra operation,
yes,
at Bletchley Park.
I think that came about, Mr. Jensel, through virtue of the fact that a certain gentleman, a Mr. Flowers, who since then got a doctorship from Newcastle University, he was at that particular time experimenting with Enigma. As a matter of fact, I've got a picture I can show you in a book, because I can mention Ultra Goes to War, can't I?
Okay.
And show you a picture of him, and here it is on your table in front of you, and it's in the back of the book. And if you'd like to look through it, you'll just find it there. There we are. There's Dr. Flowers, just receiving his doctorship at University in Newcastle. And that's the one, this is the Enigma. It's a funny looking contraption, but that's the thing he took to, that he created at Dulles Hill.
He actually made,
yes,
that
was the winner in the end. That was the winner
Dulles
in
Hill.
The end at Dulles Hill, yes.
One of the computers.
Yeah, one of the computers.
The Colossus.
That's right, the Colossus, that's right. Now here is the German. Here is, that gentleman was a well-known character. I think that was Group Captain Winterbottom, is that right?
Yes, I think
he's a very important,
published a new book.
Yes, and this is these are Germans in a trench operating an Enigma kind of telephone system. And also on the other side, you've got another picture of a German deciphering machine. There they are, in German. You see, that's a German. Different from Mars, isn't it?
Yes.
And on the other side, we've got a picture of Bletchley Park.
And you think there was a direct
link? I'm convinced there was, yes, between Bletchley Park and Dulles Hill. I think Mr. Lewin says in his book that such is the case. That, of course, that's the gentleman who wrote the book.
Once the information arrived at the Second Cabinet War Rooms, have you any idea whether it could be sent through to the First Cabinet War Rooms in Great George Street? Was there a direct connection?
I think the Cabinet War Rooms in London were the first to receive any information before we got it. You see, we were only the stepping off stone in the case of Churchill leaving Whitehall, if you know what I mean. I think myself that the first people to receive the information would be the people that operated the post office war rooms in Dollis Hill. The post office itself had their own war rooms, the same as the British wartime government had. In Whitehall, they operated their war rooms inside the research station, which was separate from the actual research station itself, because the research station were operating on such things, or experimenting with such things as noises in tanks. I remember whilst I was there, I was hearing a terrible noise, or a terrific noise, and I went over to hear, and then somebody came out and told me, he said, well, we're experimenting with a tank noise, trying to do away with the noise in tanks. The caterpillars on the tanks made such a noise that they were trying to eliminate it. That was one of the things they did at Dollis Hill, numerous things. Then they were experimenting with telephone cables. Instead of having one pair of wires and a cable, they were going to put 40 pairs of telephone cables in one channel, which I think was a very noble thing to do at that particular time of the war. But they not only experimented at Dollis Hill Research Station, all those sort of things, they were also researching in radar as well. Yeah.
And your war rooms were just really a very small part of this
absolutely,
great
yeah.
complex.
Yeah, I quite agree. Absolutely, yes. Absolutely.
Was the remainder of the complex as well protected as the war rooms?
No. You mean the post office itself?
Well, you mentioned to me that you believe there were about 15 feet of concrete, perhaps.
Yes, the paddock itself was absolutely. Well, what can I say? It was safer in Dollis in the paddock than it was in the actual buildings of the post office research station. They were just open to enemy action, and if they got a hit, they would be no more. If you know what I mean, they would be the finish. But we were protected. I mean, we could have had bombs on our building, and all we should have felt was the impact of the bomb onto the building, and I feel sure there'd be no damage done because we were so strongly built.
When you left there in 1944, was there a feeling, well, amongst the staff and yourself, that a rather sadness that the rooms had never been used for the purpose
yes,
which
I,
they
I
were
think
constructed?
That is correct, Mr. Wenzel. I think I know I felt it so. I mean, I felt that we did a good job at Dollis Hill by staying underground for all those years of the war and realising that the purpose that we were serving was for the benefit of the British war government in case Hitler had destroyed Whitehall. But as Churchill said, we were prepared, and in doing so, it was not to be that we should use Dollis Hill. And I feel that there was, as you say, a certain amount of sadness to feel that these rooms were never used. But nevertheless, we served our country, and I feel sure that that was nothing more than we could do.
I see. Finally, I wonder if we could turn to some of the individuals that we've talked about. You mentioned that you knew Mr. Rance.
Yes.
George Rance.
Yes.
Who was the curator of the first war rooms.
Yes.
In Great George Street. But what can you recall about him as an
individual? Well, he used to come out every so often to see how we were getting on, see how the place was looking, and see if it was in readiness all the time. I would say he was a very efficient man, too efficient. His job was to see that we were fully equipped, everything that Churchill wanted, things would be put at the right time, made sure that telephones were working, and we told him point blank that the telephones were tested every day. Even we used to talk scramble telephones, and we used to speak to fighter command on the tele. We used to talk to tele on the teleprinter to fighter command. And I always remember the pet phrase. We used to sit down, switch on, and type out, "Now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party." And that used to be a regular thing every day of the week, 6 days a week. Sundays we had a day off. But if I didn't do it, my sergeant did it. So you see, we were in a state of readiness all the time, and we used to bring up such places as Kneller Hall, and there's the public know that Kneller Hall is the school of music for the army, and Fighter Command at Stanmore, the War Office, the Admiralty, especially the Admiralty at Cricklewood, and some other government departments which I just cannot remember at the moment, but they were all significant to the War Cabinet's operations if they should come to Dulles Hill. But I think during the war years we had a very happy crowd of people there, especially on, we used to look forward to Wednesdays because we used to get all the ladies from, or what shall I say, char ladies from HM Officer Works. They used to come out with their buckets and brushes, come down singing, "Oh, we've had another rough night, but still here we are, you know, come back to Dulles Hill again to have a smoke and a cup of tea." That was their most important thing, cup of tea. And then they got down on their hands and knees and went through the place and cleaned it. And when they went away at night with a good old Cockney smile and humour, the place did look fit for a king to live in. But after they went, it seemed to be sad again because it went quiet, and it didn't make a difference to have all these ladies chattering because it seemed to bring the place to life. But we did have three ladies, two ladies and a supervisor, the name of Mrs. Nannery. She used to look after these two ladies and see that they did their work well. As a matter of fact, she used to sew my stripes on, or when I had my suit clean, my uniform clean, she used to take the stripes off and we sew them on again. But she also kept an eye on the colonel. And as a matter of fact, you know, whilst our colonel was there at Dulles Hill, he used to have a dog, a golden Labrador, and his name was Dan. And he, I know he's not telling stories out of school, but each day, either myself or the other sergeant used to have to take the dog out across to Gladstone Park and air him, take him for a walk in. But these are things that stand out in my mind. But I can assure you, Mr. Wenzel, this place was really kept tip-top, ready for a king to enter in it and to sleep comfortably, that I'm sure.
I don't know whether we actually have the precise time date on tape. When did you actually leave the Second Cabinet War Rooms to go to the Rotunda?
Well, we didn't actually leave Dulles Hill or Cabinet War or Paddock. We still had to keep it going, and one sergeant or myself, second in command, as I was at the time, had to take a tour of duty in Rotunda, namely HMS Anson War Room. But it wasn't, as far as my estimation, so important as Dulles Hill, because there wasn't the rooms there allocated to the wartime government or cabinet. I think myself it was a building or the bottom floor which was occupied by 21 Army Group, because the first and second floors were occupied by the most important people at that time, the Home Office, because they were partly responsible for the safety of the British public at that time of the bombing. I mean, they knew immediately where, what city or what part of the country was going to be bombed. I mean, even in the basement, we had a telephone exchange in Rotunda. They were receiving information from France, telling our people, the Home Office security officers on duty, that where the Germans were going to bomb. They knew they were going to bomb Coventry. The message went through, you see, to Coventry to receive these messages and be prepared, like they did in London. They know certain parts of London they were going to bomb. It was a really a hive of industry as regards the communications were concerned. And yet there they were, buried in the bowels of the earth, tucked away from nowhere. Nobody knew they were there. Yet, although they were with us, they were divided by a door and had their own steps. And there was about four girls, all on their own, day and night, on this PBX, operated for the home security war rooms.
And this was on the ground floor?
On the basement, on our floor, on the in the basement, yes. They were cut off from us. They only could get to our basement, and our basement office through that door. And it was through the generosity of the government, they got a key. But as I say, they really did a fine job of work. They used to come off duty and come back on again with a cheery smile. They'd had a night of blitz, and still they came back and did their job to the way they were taught to do it, as the leftists are or do. But I think, by and large, that all the people that worked in bunkers during the war years were a happy lot. They realised that they were doing a job of work, although they were hidden away from the outside world. They did accomplish something, although their rewards were of nothing, or it must have been of some use, I feel sure, even in their own country or in their own hearts, they'd done something towards or helping to gain victory for the British people.
With just yourself and your Sergeant Smith,
yes,
you must have had some problems about arranging leave. How much leave?
Well, that was due. Well, as a matter of fact, I think we were very generous. It was generous, I think, from the point of view that as we lived underground for so long, we were entitled to more leave. Well, I wouldn't say entitled, but we were given more leave because we had our commanding officer, say, realised what it's like to live underground. And, I mean, he made the most of it whilst he was there. He used to go home practically every weekend. And when he was there during the tour of duty, say, he'd send one of us away. We both couldn't go away together. If he came back from his weekend, say, he'd turn around and say to me, John, it's your turn next week. You go home to Plymouth or wherever you want to go, he said. Peter will stay here, but Peter can go many times because he lives in Wembley, you see. Which, as you know, Wembley's not very far from Dollis Hill, just a bus ride, because I had to go home to the West Country, and that meant money. But he was always prepared to sign me a furlough ticket, a pass, you know. But, yes, I think he was pretty generous. I mean, we had more leave in Dollis Hill than the short time I had in France. Well, as you know, it was difficult in France to get one leave. I only had one leave. I was due to come home on Easter in 1940, but they cancelled all leave because they thought Germany were about to stop the phony war and start operations. Well, it did come to life. They did, because when I did come out of France, the Germans had broken through the Maginot Line, of course. And then when I returned to France, I never found my unit. I found myself in the south of France in Brittany, sunning myself while Dunkirk was taking place. Rather peculiar, isn't it? But as I say, getting back to Dollis Hill, I think they were happy days, and we were never short. If I wanted to go home, I could go home. You know, there was no difficulty if I wasn't feeling well. The colonel would say, well, John, if you want to go home, you can go home for a few days. Do so. Peter can, you know, stay there and run the show. But I may go home for the weekend. But if you're in trouble, you can ring me up at Guildford, you know. But or if he should be needed immediately, to contact him right away, you know. But fortunately, that never happened. Because I think things ran so smoothly, where Dollis Hill was concerned, that I think that it was one of the reasons why, well, that the British cabinet was safe from the, what's the word can I say, of being bombed out, because Churchill was prepared. Churchill knew, could read, Churchill could... He realised that he had another place to go, and I think that gave him all the confidence in the world. Although he didn't like it very much, he didn't even like War Room Number 1, where he lived. But I enjoyed myself. I never wasted my time either whilst I was there. I even took up studying accountancy. I took up bookkeeping when I used to go out evenings at Pittman's College. I mean, it meant either staying in and vegetating or else going out and doing something good for yourself. So I took up a course and went to Pittman's College in Shoot Old Pill. Well, one night when I went there after the Blitz, there wasn't any college. It just burnt the ground. I've even come home off duty and found my wife in her nightdress, bring out firebombs, because she was also an ARP warden when she was off duty from work. And these are the sort of things we think about and look back over. They are memories, and I think really it's big in that we're living more in dangerous times now than ever. I think in my experience of life that in the war years, although we had a rough time as regards to V2s and V1s, I think it was the sense of the humour and the spirit of the Cockney people in London that helped us to win the war. Because I've seen people in the undergrounds, and I've even walked over their edge because there'd been so many people there, packed like sardines on the underground platforms. And yet they come up smiling, going back to work. They even heard our char ladies talk about them. Where were you last night when the Blitz took place? Oh, I was so-and-so. I was down so-and-so underground there. Oh, yes. And how did you get on? And they went on in their old Cockney accent. But they still came to work. They were still reported for duty in the cabinet office at 6 o'clock in the morning. They still did their stint and still went back. And some of these ladies, by the way, were old. They weren't young. Some of them were in their 60s, 70s. But speaking in the vernacular, them were the days.
Was it? We've talked very widely about your experiences in the war rooms. Is there anything more you'd like to add before we close, Mr. Milne?
Well, when I went to Cabinet War Room 3 in Great Peter Street, on one occasion, which I shall never forget, and that was meeting two very important people, and namely Lord Beaverbrook, who was the Minister for Aircraft Production, and our late Herbert Morrison, who was then Home Secretary, who eventually became Deputy Prime Minister to Mr. Attlee. And about 11 o'clock at night, I'd gone to bed, and there was a buzz on the bell at the gates of the war room, or of the cabinet, war room. And when I got out of my dressing gown and went to the gates, there was these two stately gentlemen come and asked if they could come in. So I said, well, I'm afraid you can't. So the first thing, I want to know who you are, and secondly, for what purpose. Lord Beaverbrook. And you know this gentleman? Well, I know him by face, but I'm not sure who he is. Well, he's the gentleman upstairs, he said. Mr. Herbert Morrison. Upstairs, at the Home Secretary,